This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and it is award season in Hollywood, the time when stars dress to impress on the red carpet and the industry looks back at the standout films from the previous year. Today on Movies on the Radio, we're going to take a look back at some of your favorite and least favorite films from 2014. Joining me are two film experts, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thanks, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State University. Marcia, welcome.
Thank you.
So earlier this week, the foreign press honored some of the 2014 hits at the Golden Globe Awards. Tina Fey, Amy Poehler were there, and they highlighted, of course, one of the biggest stories in the film industry.
Tonight we celebrate all the great television shows that we know and love, as well as all the movies that North Korea was okay with. The biggest story in Hollywood this year was when North Korea threatened an attack if Sony Pictures released the interview, forcing us all to pretend we wanted to see it. Referred to the interview as absolutely intolerable and a wanton act of terror. Even more amazing, not the worst review the movie got.
The interview, how big a deal do you think was that, the story around the interview, Laura?
Well, I think it was very big. Mostly, I think the side issue is that once the Sony computers were hacked and the studios have deeply invested in digital movies, completely scrapping the idea of movies on 35 millimeter film, that means that every studio is vulnerable to a Korean pre-release of whatever they're going to be scheduling.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's certainly the case. And I think, to me, the pivotal part of this story is, are we going to look back on this in years to come as a moment where the kind of shift towards alternative distribution networks kind of really kicked into high gear? Because, of course, the alternative to theatrical, which, is in somewhat of an artifact of an earlier age that people went to see movies in movie theaters, is doing immediate digital distribution or simultaneous digital distribution. And so I think people are going to look at this moment very carefully, as we see films being released in the next year or so, regardless of this kind of ridiculous situation with the threat of terrorist acts.
Yeah, but see how ridiculous it is, and it worked. And that, of course, we're all deeply aware, somewhere deep in our subconscious, of the power of asymmetrical warfare and the fact that our technology is our worst enemy, right? So not only are we as a nation vulnerable because we got a lot of stuff which could be nuked with, control, alt, delete. I mean, think if you're a Bank of America, how nerve-wracking this is. But also, as you say, as suggest, asymmetrical economies. I mean, the fact is that whole industries built on digital technology are really at the mercy of whoever doesn't like their film, right?
Although I must agree with, I do feel terrorized by stupid vulgar comedies myself. And if there are fewer of them, regardless of the little political patina that they put over their bathroom jokes, that's really okay with me.
Well, and also just I think from the perspective of the studios, thinking about, well, how, if you are going to start doing digital distribution simultaneous with theatrical distribution, well, what's the monetary situation, because obviously you can't charge the same per ticket price you do to get in a theater. I do think that this is going to be a moment, though, that we look back on.
They'll figure it out. Okay, let's talk about some of the favorites. Laura, what was your top pick from 2014?
Well, I really loved The Grand Budapest Hotel, which was made by Wes Anderson. He's a filmmaker that not everyone loves, but I love him for his extremely idiosyncratic, gorgeously designed, hilariously funny and truly unique films.
Let's get a little clip.
I'm not leaving.
I beg your pardon?
I'm not leaving.
Why not?
I'm frightened.
Of what?
I fear this may be the last time we ever see each other.
Why on earth would that be the case?
Well, I can't put it into words, but I feel it.
Well, for goodness sake, there's no reason for you to leave us if you'd rather...
Come with me.
To Lutz?
Please.
Give me your hand. You've nothing to fear. You're always anxious before you travel. I admit you appear to be suffering a more acute attack on this occasion, but truly and honestly, oh dear God, what have you done to your fingernails?
I beg your pardon?
This diabolical varnish, the colour is completely wrong.
Oh, really? Don't you like it?
It's not that I don't like it. I am physically repulsed.
All right, there it is, a scene from The Grand Budapest Hotel. What was it in particular you liked about this film?
Well, here you hear Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes, who I've always found him to be rather a chilly actor, and he's so hilariously funny in this movie. And the dialogue is constructed in such an elegant way that he actually makes the F word sound dirty again. I mean, we've been deluged with it for 30 years in the movies, and every time he uses it, you just jump out of your seat because it's so incongruous. And it's so gorgeous. Every little detail of the film is so beautiful. Costumes, sets, photography, everything's gorgeous.
I think there are very few contemporary directors who can create a universe the way that Wes Anderson creates a universe. And it is every single detail. And even though I'm tiring a little bit of the Wes Anderson quirky characteristics and style, I have to appreciate the fact that I do feel like I've seen a visual delight every time I've seen one of his films.
Well, Marsha, what was your top pick for 2014?
Well, I really, really loved Inherent Vice. This is the latest P.T. Anderson film, and it's based on a Thomas Pynchon novel. And it is just, I think, one of the most atmospheric, interesting, visual, quirky, funny, bizarre films that I've seen in a long time. And I just had such an incredible experience of watching a movie that I thought was just completely artfully done.
So, what's the beef here exactly?
It just doesn't have much to do with your specialty, which I understand is marine law.
We got plenty of crime on the high seas, Lieutenant.
Okay, well, so far we have murder and kidnapping. We can work in pirates if it would make you more comfortable. Either way, it's high profile.
Yeah, but given your history of harassment with my client, this will never make it to trial.
No, I think we could probably take this all the way to trial, but with our luck, you know, the jury pool will be 99% hippie.
Well, that's a change of venue to maybe like Orange County. Not as many hippies down there, you know.
So who are you working for?
Clients pay me for work, Doc. Clients pay me for work, Doc.
So, I mean, first off, the performances in this film are fantastic. You heard Benicio del Toro and Josh Brolin. Joaquin Phoenix is in this. Owen Wilson. It's one of those all-star casts that you go, uh-oh, that must be masking some sin. But to me, Anderson got incredible performances out of them. And one of the things that I loved about this film is it felt like watching a 70s film. It didn't feel like it captured the 70s so much as it felt like a 70s film. So it felt like A Long Goodbye or Chinatown,
well,
or something
like that. What would
characterize
that? What's a 70s film?
Well, I mean, in terms of just the kind of the aesthetics, B, the kind of cynical, dark characterization of this California drug hippie universe, kind of post kind of political hippie, kind of positive counterculture into this descent of kind of narcissism and self-destructiveness. And it really felt like watching a 70s film to me. And I think that must be a very, very hard thing to pull off, because we've seen so many films about the 70s in the past few years that are like, they have the style or whatever, but this felt like it. And the music was fantastic. I mean, just I loved it from start to finish.
Well, 70s was kind of a gritty noir redux itself. So then to do it again is kind of rough.
And this is kind of like a classic detective story, but it's told through the twisted universe of Thomas Pynchon. If you've ever read a Pynchon novel, I mean, when I first heard that Anderson was adapting this, I thought, oh my gosh, how on earth is somebody going to pull this off? And I think this is a very sophisticated adaptation.
We asked our staff to give us their favorites, and here's one.
My name is Hadi Mawagdi, and I'm a producer for The State of Things. My favorite film in 2014 was Citizen Four. My favorite thing about Citizen Four was reading the exchanges via the deep web between Laura Poitras, the film's director, and Edward Snowden. He was taking a big risk when he decided to tell on the NSA, and to me, he's a patriot. And I just found that what he did was important, not only for the security of citizens around the world, but specifically for citizens in America. It's a really interesting documentary, and I love how scary it is.
Laura, at this stage, I can offer nothing more than my word. I am a senior government employee in the intelligence community. I hope you understand that contacting you is extremely high risk. For now, know that every border you cross, every purchase you make, every call you dial, every cell phone tower you pass, friend you keep, site you visit, and subject line you type is in the hands of a system whose reach is unlimited, but whose safeguards are not. In the end, if you publish the source material, I will likely be immediately implicated. I ask only that you ensure this information makes it home to the American public. Thank you, and be careful. Citizen 4.
First off, I think Laura Poitras is one of our most important documentarians making films. It's about Snowden. It's about this kind of culture of surveillance that we're all living in. And at a time where so many films are intent on scaring us with these kind of big explosions and violence, I mean, this is a film that is about things that are very real and very scary. And the New York Times did a profile of her in their magazine a couple of years ago, or maybe just a year ago, that's absolutely fantastic and worth reading about what she has suffered as a result of her determination to tell these stories about the way that information is being handled by our government.
Well, there are so many great documentaries every year, and I'm on the screening committee for the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, and there were other fantastic documentary films I wanted to mention, particularly The Case Against Eight, which talks about marriage equality in front of the Supreme Court, and also Life Itself, which was a very intimate biography of Roger Ebert, both of which were really excellent documentaries last year.
You know, it is interesting when you talk about Laura Poitras and all that she suffered, Edward Snowden, and the kind of debate about what he did. If you think about the interview and how obvious it was that North Carolina, what I really meant was North Korea, you know, is a rogue state. How dare they? How dare they censor our films? And yet here we are censoring ourselves. And actually, there's a large percentage of our population that says we should be censoring ourselves. So leave North Korea alone, folks. We do a lot of punishment. We punish a lot of people who try to end censorship in this country. We are talking about movies on the radio on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The best and worst from 2014 continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking about the best and worst films of 2014. I'm joined, as always, for Movies on the Radio by Laura Boies, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, and a film that was 12 years in the making, took home the Golden Globe for the best drama. Let's hear one listener's take.
My name's Ferdinand Stout. My favorite movie of the year was Boyhood. I mean, just the concept that it took 12 years and the whole idea of this thing would blow up at any point. It just was kind of cool that it actually came off.
Goodbye, yard. Goodbye, crepe myrtle. Goodbye, mailbox. Goodbye, box of stuff Mommy won't let us take with us, but we don't want to throw away. Goodbye, house. I'll never like Mommy as much for making us move.
Samantha, why don't you say goodbye to that little attitude, okay? Because we're not taking that in the car.
Goodbye, old lady. Listen to rock music and ride the motorcycle.
There it is, a little clip from Boyhood. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have not been a lifelong Linklater fan, but this film I thought was really, really well done. And as the listener said, I mean, it had a great concept, a very challenging concept of making a film over the course of 12 years and returning to film that cast once a year. But it was also executed, I think, really, really well. And the thing I kept thinking about when I was watching it is it's kind of like if you had a record which is that circular disc that spins around with music on it for the kids in the audience. And you would just drop the needle, in a song, and then you lift the needle, and then you just drop it someplace else. And it was so well edited, and that feeling that you are really kind of not only watching a fiction film about, what it means to kind of grow up and change, but also kind of a documentary about how these actors changed over time. And I found it very affecting. And I've talked to so many people who felt really emotionally moved and kind of devastated by this film in ways that I think very few films I've heard people react to.
Well, it talks about the very mundane aspects of life, and the way it's edited, you don't necessarily see where it changes from one year to another. So there's that sense of flow and change. And this movie is almost 3 hours long. It does not seem anywhere near
that
long. And it's incredibly moving. Although I have to say, one of the things that I thought about is we've had a similar experience at the movies to this before, in that we've watched Daniel Radcliffe grow up the same way in the Harry Potter movies. Mm. And for my daughter, who's exactly the same age as Daniel Radcliffe and grew up with him at that same moment every time a Harry Potter movie came out, there was Daniel Radcliffe a year older and she was a year older. And in fact, Boyhood kind of makes an oblique reference to that by having the lead character go to a Harry Potter event, as if Linklater knew that, yes, we would be thinking about that at the same time.
And then there's the Michael Apted 7-Up documentaries, which return to this group of British kids every 7 years and kind of checked in on where they were in their lives. So this is kind of a cinematic condensed version.
But every 7 years is like the horrific version of a high school reunion where it's like, oh my God, what happened to you?
It keeps you going, and why it doesn't seem like it's so long after 3 hours. Well, as I mentioned, we did talk to some of our staff and asked them about their favorites in 2014, and here's another.
My name is Bob Levin, and I work at WNC Radio, and my favorite film for 2014 was Snowpiercer. It's a great science fiction flick, and good acting, and all the snow and ice reminded me of my hometown of Buffalo, New York.
Up at you, Katharina Branch, you filthy ingrates! You people, who would I know for the benevolent Wilfred, would have frozen solid 18 years ago today. You people, who have suckled the generous titty of Wilfred ever since, for food and shelter. And now, in front of our hallowed water supply section, no less, you repay his kindness with violent hooliganism. You scum. Precisely 74% of you shall die.
My friend, you suffer from the misplaced optimism of the doomed.
There you go, a little paper. By the way, as a native of Buffalo, New York myself, I will tell you the only place I would enjoy a snow scene would be in the comfort and warmth of a movie theater. You really don't need to be there. But anyway, yeah, Snowpiercer.
Well, I think we've heard Tilda Swinton in this clip as well, as in the Grand Budapest Hotel, and she really has a knack for picking amazing projects to work in. And Marcia and I were just talking about how much we loved a movie that we think came out this year called Only Lovers Left Alive, which is a vampire movie by Jim Jarmusch.
Fantastic.
With Tom Hiddleston, in which Morocco and the ruins of Detroit are the home of the undead.
She's got to be one of the best actresses working today. But Snowpiercer, I mean, I love a good dystopia. And this one has, I mean, first off, it's a Korean director. It's a great conceit of basically the world boiled down to people living on a train and surviving, kind of going around and moving in this kind of icy atmosphere. And it's, you know, the class system on the train and power. And it's just, it's really fun. It's super, super violent. I thought it was a great film.
We talk about film. When we rate them, we always think about dramas and comedies, and sci-fi is still, I guess, a genre. But film and sci-fi were really made for each other in ways that you can argue about literature, possibly. But in film, this is the medium, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think if you look at the box office take for this year, I mean, the films over and over again are the big sci-fi films. Those are the ones that are bringing in all of the money. So they're also what sell.
Well, for some people really have an appetite for destruction in these films. I have to say I'm sort of over the whole dystopia thing, in part because, you know, if a nuclear bomb is going to fall, I want to be on ground zero. I do not want to be one of those people clawing for survival.
And watching only old movies because all the good ones are gone. We were talking about our next is actually a listener pick, already taken home several awards, including the Golden Globe for Best Actor to Michael Keaton. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Teresa Hart, and my favorite movie in 2014 was the movie Birdman. And the reason for that is that I found the characters to be multifaceted in the way they explore the conflict, all the challenges that they have in their lives. I think it's a great film demonstrating the yin and yang of life as they examine the, you know, just the problems of ego and fame and basic mental health. The performances of Michael Keaton and Edward Norton are brilliant and crisp.
Do you really think you'll be ready for opening tomorrow?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, previews are pretty much a train wreck. We can't seem to get through a performance without a raging fire. I'm broke. I'm not sleeping, like, you know, at all. And this play kind of starting to feel like a miniature, deformed version of myself that just keeps following me around and, like, hitting me in the like a tiny little hammer. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Never mind.
A clip from Birdman, Laura.
Well, this is, if you boil it down to its essence, it's let's put on a show, a film. But yet every moment is such an incredible cliffhanger as far as all of the disasters that are always on the edge of happening, in part because actors are kind of crazy. And Michael Keaton is fantastic. Edward Norton's character is such an incredible loose cannon. And I talked to my daughter who works in New York theater, and she said, I know 10 people exactly like that Edward Norton character, and I hate all of them.
Nice.
Well, and this seems to be a film that people are talking about so much for the performances of these actors and also having a kind of depth to the characters, which if you think about some of the, again, the big blockbuster films like Transformers and, you know, Captain America, Spider-Man, Planet of the Apes, Hunger Game. I mean, there's not a whole lot
of
depth there.
They're plot-driven.
Yeah, they're all plot. And so I think it's very refreshing when people go to a movie and they see a film in which they can really explore the kind of mind and the psychology of a character.
Here's my problem with films a lot, and that is that they reflect, you know, I know 10 people like that. I know 30 people have been in that kind of a relationship. I think to myself, so why did I pay $6 or $12 to see the 31st? In other words, it reflects what's going on around me, but it doesn't really add depth. You said something very interesting here, in that the characters, if the acting is really powerful, there's a way in which some deeper issues are explored in the performance itself. And I wonder if that's something that films can do. In other words, the problem for the film industry is you got to sell it.
Right.
You don't want to get too deep, because if you make people think, they're not going to pay their money for their show.
That's very cynical.
But this is the way to do it. And in some ways that it happens, the best way it happens in film is through performance and not through a lot of, you know.
Well, I think that's you're asking the basic question, which is why do you go to the movies?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it is the acting. I want to see actors who I enjoy, I mean, just looking at.
Yeah.
I like to see their performance. I like this to see the way they interpret human nature that makes me reflect on my own experience and the experiences of people that
I know. But you also like to see, I mean, Grand Budapest Hotel, beautiful costumes and sets and kind of an intricate universe that's realized outside of the real world. And so, I mean, I think there's a lot of different reasons, obviously, that we go to the movies.
We had a lot of folks who really, including local critics, who really love the film Whiplash.
You're rushing. Here we go. Ready? Okay. 5, 6, and. Dragging just a hair. Wait for my cue. 5, 6, 7. Rushing. 5, 6, and. Dragging. Why do you suppose I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman?
I don't know.
Sure you do.
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
Start counting.
5, 6, 7.
In four, damn it! Look at me!
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
I don't know.
Count again.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Rushing or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference.
There we go. Whiplash.
And there you hear J.T. Simmons, who just won a Golden Globe for his performance in that film yesterday, earlier this week. When I asked people what their favorite movie of the year was, Neil Morris, Isaac Weeks, Denver Hill from the Colony Theater, all picked Whiplash. Glenn McDonald, when he reviewed it for the Independent Weekly, said that he nearly had a panic attack in the last scene because it was so stressful. He said, asthmatics bring your inhaler. So clearly this abusive mentor-student relationship really strikes something very familiar in a lot of viewers.
And this was a film that I got told by so many people was fantastic, and it did not last very long in theaters. Like so many films, it was kind of in and out. And I wish I would have
seen it. Well, and this is comes back to Frank's point. Why am I going to submit myself to this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I didn't see it. And just based on what I heard, sounds kind of mean. I don't think I will. though I was grateful for the line, why do you suppose I just threw a chair at your head for the radio, for a radio audience? That line alone kind of saved it for me. Steve Carell, known for his comic acting, tackled a more serious role in our next pick.
Do you have any idea why I asked you to come here today?
No.
Well, Mark, do you have any idea who I am?
No.
Some rich guy calls you on the phone. I want Mark Schultz to come visit me. Well, I'm a wrestling coach, and I have a deep love the sport of wrestling. And I wanted to speak with you about your future, about what you hope to achieve. What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world. I want to go to Worlds and win gold. I want to go to the 88 Olympics in Seoul. Win gold.
Good. I'm proud of you.
Comic actors always want to play serious roles because they think that they're being trivialized by playing comedy. In my mind, there's nothing harder than making somebody laugh. So it's in a way kind of an expected choice that someone who's so well known for his comedy would want to
It's
make
interesting because you
film.
Talk – yes, you talk to actors and they will tell you the hardest thing to do is comedy. And yet you're right. Once you become a comic actor, you can't then break in because everybody keeps – kind of laughing on the third beat and you say, no, serious line.
Right. Well, and it's so easy to make money off of someone, you know, casting them in the same kinds of roles that is a kind of predictable box office. So it's a much riskier game to stick someone in a role that's not in their typical bailiwick.
So let's see. One film that came out late last year was a favorite for our next listener. Let's listen.
My name's Peter Delgado. I'm from Carrboro. And my favorite movie of 2014 was Interstellar. I liked it for probably three reasons. I think with the sort of effects of climate change becoming more and more pronounced in the next few years, there's a real exigency behind the questions the film asks about, you know, what we as a species would do should this planet become uninhabitable. Second, I thought there were really just great performances all around. You know, we're going through a bit of a McConaissance, and I thought McConaughey totally stole the show, but Anne Hathaway was great as well, Jessica Chastain and Michael Caine as well. Third, you know, film is really just like an intensely audiovisual medium, and I think one of the reasons we like to go to films is to see and hear things that we would never be able to experience otherwise. And on this front, Interstellar just absolutely delivered with some spectacular visuals, the wormhole, the alien planet. Seeing it in IMAX was a truly unforgettable experience.
We used to look up in the sky and wonder at our place in the stars. Now just look down and worry about our place in the dirt.
Go for main engine start. T-minus 10.
We must confront the reality that nothing in our solar system can help us.
9.
I've got kids, Professor.
How long
would I be gone?
8.
I'm asking you to trust me.
7.
Murph. You have to talk to me, Murph.
6.
I need to fix this before I go.
You have no idea when you're coming back.
5. Main engine start.
Couldn't you have told her you were going to save the world?
No.
4.
When you become a parent.
3.
One thing becomes really clear.
2.
And that's that you want to make sure your children feel safe.
1.
I'm coming back. I love you forever.
There it is, a clip from Interstellar, one of the favorites from 2014.
Well, and sci-fi has always been the most thoughtful, I think, engaged of the genres. You know, if you look at sci-fi films, you know, in the 50s and in the 70s, and they're always about the world we're living in and the world we might just be going into. And I think as we become more aware of what's happening with our environment and the climate, it's inescapable that this is the fiction that's going to become our reality, and it already is our reality. So, you know, like Snowpiercer that deals with this kind of climatological disaster zone, this is another film that speaks to that.
I think there's also there are two kinds of science fiction. One of them is brainy science fiction, which is like the 2001 kind of science fiction. And while a movie like Guardians of the Galaxy may address a similar kind of issue, it's done in a much more you know, pop culture-y kind of way that distances itself from the brainier science fiction of something like Interstellar.
The best and the worst of 2014. It's our review with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon, and it will continue on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today on Movies on the Radio, talking about the best and worst of 2014. Laura Boyes, Marcia Gordon are with me, and we're listening to some of your choices for top movies of the past year. We asked our staff to weigh in, and here's one of their favorites.
My name is Anita Rao, and I'm a producer here on The State of Things. And my favorite movie from 2014 was Obvious Child, starring Jenny Slate, who plays a aspiring stand-up comedian, Donna Stern, who embarrasses herself a lot in her stand-up comedy and just is very lovable. But I think what I love the most about this film is how it portrays female friendship, how nuanced it can be. I also really love the way that this movie, through a variety of characters who've experienced abortion, really shows a much more realistic portrayal of something that 30%+ of American women will experience at some point in their lifetime.
I came here tonight to say to you that I am pregnant. Ooh. Ooh, okay, all right. Testing the waters. I dropped that one down. The second thing that I would like to say right now out loud, and I'm going to say it out loud right now. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Just rolling along with this out loud right now, is that I am going to have an abortion. Okay. Keep breathing. Tomorrow, which is Valentine's Day. So we'll start from there.
There are a lot of comedies now that are sort of woman-centered. Girls on HBO is one of those. I suppose I have to bring up Bridesmaids if I must, and other movies that talk about women's experience in a comic way. This film is described as a romantic comedy, which I'm not exactly sure I would describe it that way, but romantic comedy has gone through a huge crisis because since the sexual revolution, there is no reason to keep two characters out of bed the way it used to be in the old days. And this movie gets the sex part out of the way right at the beginning, and then the challenge is, can these people actually have a meaningful relationship, which in a way turns the formula upside down. So I thought that was very interesting. And as far as the female friendship part, her best friend is played by Gabby Hoffman, who plays the exact same part in Wild for Reese Witherspoon. So apparently she is the go-to best friend right now.
Well, and again, if you think about the big box office films of this year, you know, Transformers and X-Men and Hobbit and Captain America, Amazing Spider-Man 2, I mean, not a whole lot of female friendship going on there and focusing on these kind of more intimate stories. So I think for people who are not interested in that big explosive men hitting and exploding things kind of films, occasionally a woman doing the same thing, you know, it's very refreshing to have other opportunities at the box office.
Okay, so we'll pause here and ask you to what extent TV over the last couple of decades is affecting the way movies are made. Reality TV, the idea of things being more confessional and this sense of verite. Do you think that's having an impact on cinema, or is it still?
Well, certainly it has a big effect on stand-up comedy, which is what this movie is about. And people reveal so much about themselves so easily. You know, when you go back to Citizen Four and the whole privacy issue, a certain number of us expect, oh, we have no privacy anymore. We're expected to post pictures of ourselves on Facebook every single day. And people of a certain age maybe are a little less forthcoming in the whole sharing department.
Although, again, I would, you know, if you think about the blockbuster films, they have nothing to do, to my mind, with what's happening in television. And I'm no expert on consumer television.
They're escapism. I mean, that's what their job is, and their box office numbers prove that they're successful.
But don't you think television is getting less and less escapist? It's less and less fictive. It's becoming more and more, you know, watch so-and-so do so-and-so humiliating thing in the real world.
Yeah, because what I think I just heard you say is that we're going to the movies to escape television, which is pretty wacky. Think about it. Well, you mentioned Wilde. The next pick is a biographical drama, a memoir adapted to a film, and it was very personal for our next listener, Virginia. Let's listen.
As someone who has recently lost a parent, I was able to completely understand the plight that Cheryl Strayed / Reese Witherspoon went through in the movie. And as you're watching some of the scenes and you're watching this person's life unravel, you know that everybody knows that their parent is going to die at some point. And most of us expect people to get over it in about 2 weeks. But watching this person's life, it completely self-destructed. And it was great to see sort of how she went about dealing with it and getting herself back on track.
Can you stop humming that song? What is wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? I'm happy. Happy people sing.
Why are you happy? We have nothing, Mom.
Nothing. No. We're rich in love.
Oh, my God. Please. Don't even start with that. We're both waitressing full time.
Oh, we're students.
And we're going to have loans for the rest of our lives. This house is falling apart. You're all by yourself because you married some abusive alcoholic. And then I come home and you're singing? What part of it do you not get?
There's nothing I don't get, believe me. But then what? Cheryl, if there's one thing I could teach you, it's how to find your best self. And when you do, how to hold on to it for dear life.
And this is your best self.
I'm trying. Do I regret marrying an abusive alcoholic? No. Not for 1 second, because I got you. And your brother. See how it works. It isn't easy, but it's worth it.
Well, one of the interesting things about this film, first of all, you can see that Reese Witherspoon is extremely mean to her mother, played by Laura Dern, and that part of her self-destructiveness certainly must have been the guilt that she felt about, you know, how poorly she had treated her mother. So she goes into the spiral of sex addiction and heroin use. But then she hikes the Pacific Coast Trail 1,000 miles up the West Coast, which is also a kind of addictive behavior. The one thing that, not having read the book, the film made me wonder, could she stop that addictive hiking once she had reached the end of the trail? Did it really resolve all of her personal problems? Because lots of times people just change their addiction from one thing to another.
Although hiking, you know, in the greater scheme of things, not a terrible thing to be addicted to.
You know, I'll tell you, screening for Full Frame, we talk about over documentation, so many people, they do the ultra marathon or they bike across the country. They have the GoPro on their helmet and they document every second of it because it's supposed to be meaningful to everyone else, and they can't stop.
Though if you hike long enough and you are alone with yourself long enough, you might realize that overcoming your problems is not really the issue at all, but learning how to integrate them. And that seems to be a part of the film. Right?
Right. That is exactly the conclusion that she seems to arrive at.
So that's kind of a good thing. We talked about books that are becoming movies. You mentioned that. And this next film features some unlikely allies. Laura, tell us about Pride.
Well, Pride is about gay guys in London in the 1980s that realize that the police are not beating them up with the same amount of regularity because they're, in fact, all beating up the miners during the miner strike. And they decide that they would raise money to support the striking miners in solidarity with the fact that they, too, were an oppressed minority.
Grab hold of this, will you, Matt? Oh, no, sorry.
Just for 5 minutes till the friends get here. Come on.
It's just that I don't really want to be too visible.
Was it your first bride?
Yeah, first anything.
Yeah, well, this is the best way, and you can throw yourself in.
The thing is I'm actually from Bromley.
Well, don't worry about that. We're a broad church.
No, I mean, it's the train. It's further out than people think, and
hey,
I've
been dragging this thing on my own since Marble Arch. Where are their bookies? I'm
surprised you have to ask that question, Mike, coming from Accrington.
Mike, does anything get rid of blood weights?
No. Where's Mark now?
Wait, listen up, everyone.
Where exactly have you been?
I want everyone to take a bucket and start rattling. This is for the miners.
Miners? We agreed on a banner, Mark.
It's a show of solidarity. Who hates the miners? Thatcher? Who else? The police, the public, and the tabloid press. It sounds familiar.
Surely,
but the only problem we've got that they haven't is Mary Whitehouse, and that can only be a matter of time.
Mark.
I know, it's not been planned, it's not been thought through, but it's a really good idea, isn't it? Isn't it?
What am I supposed to do with this?
Give it to the lesbians, they love a banner.
Oh, for God's sake. Right, looks like you're off the up, mate.
Good lad.
Whatever Mark says, we do it. Don't ask me why.
A clip from Pride.
Sometimes people kind of sneer at the feel-good movie. I mean, other feel-good movies this year were things like The 100-Foot Journey and Chef with Jon Favreau. But I actually find it very satisfying to have a situation where there's clearly injustice, and over the course of 90 minutes or 2 hours, these issues are resolved, and that maybe you feel a resolve in yourself that there's some hopefulness as far as people's prejudices.
Well, and interestingly enough, it's kind of the opposite of what happens in The Imitation Game, which is a film about someone who is, you know, repressing, you know, his sexuality throughout his career, and then the kind of devastating consequences once that cat is out of the bag.
Well, let's hear a clip from Imitation Game.
I'm Donnie Kay. I live in Raleigh. I saw almost every movie this year, but I think one of my favorites was The Imitation Game. On so many levels, I thought the acting was superior. Almost everybody had a memorable role that I would want to see it again and again, I think. And also the fact that the character who was the main star was living a life that was an imitation of his life, because he was a gay man living in a world where gay was not acceptable. So in all ways, he was trying to crack the code of life and try to figure out how to fit in the world. So I thought on almost every level, the movie worked, and it was affecting and beautiful, and it broke my heart at the end. I loved it.
What's the matter?
What if I don't fancy being with Joan in that way?
Because you're a homosexual.
I suspected. Should I tell her?
You know, in my admittedly limited experience, women tend to be a bit touchy about accidentally marrying homosexuals. Perhaps not spreading this information about might be in your best interest.
I care for her, I truly do. I just don't know if I can pretend about...
You can't tell anyone, Alan. It's illegal.
So this is what you can't tell from the clip. This is a World War II Enigma Machine film. And, you know, it's such an incredible story, amazing story in terms of, you know, the history and these, you know, the role that these people played in it. I found it to be such an ordinary, conventional film. Frankly, I found it quite boring and unengaging, even though I felt that the story was so fascinating. So this is a perfect example of personal taste in films, that some things resonate with some people. I'm sure some people would see Inherent Vice and go, oh my God, what is wrong with that woman? Why would she love that film? But, you know, that is a film that I thought captured a kind of period in a really challenging way. And this one told a very interesting story, but I felt like I could have read a book.
Well, I really enjoyed The Imitation Game. And one of the ways that it kind of circumvented a more conventional structure was that it had a fractured timeline using flashbacks. The Theory of Everything, in which Eddie Redmayne plays Dr. Stephen Hawking, was a much more conventional beginning-to-end great man biopic, which I found, in spite of his fantastic performance, a lot less engaging. But I thought the whole story of the Enigma Machine and the breaking of the code, and as the listener said, the way he was living, you know, an imitation game himself. And it gets back to just enjoying watching all of these fantastic British actors, Benedict Cumberbatch and Charles Dance and Mark Strong and Rory Kinnear, all fantastic performers.
But it gets to this question, too, the idea of the story within the story, so that we're all enigmas. We all have our own code. We're all speaking in code and disclosing what we want and revealing and concealing, you know, what we want to keep hidden. The subtext of the whole film, you know, the question is, literature has been doing that very well for a long time. Is that the province of literature to have those sort of multiple deep themes happening in film, you know, finds it more difficult to do? Or do you have examples of films that you really loved in which the form itself was an indication of part of the theme and where it was supposed to take us kind of psychologically?
Well, I mean, I think that's a big question. We could do a whole show on that, Frank. But, I mean, I will say, since Inherent Vice, since that seems to be the film that I'm talking about and advocating for today, and that's, you know, based on this Pynchon novel that is, you know, as with all Pynchon novels, very experimental and not interested in conveying a linear, clear narrative in which characters always make sense, what they're saying, what they're doing. You know, I think that's a film that really captured the form as well as the content. And I can't speak, I didn't read the book on which Imitation Game was based, but I'm assuming it was a very kind of faithful telling of that story. I just found it to be stylistically and visually and narratively, you know, uninteresting. I would have been happier watching a documentary about this person rather than watching a kind of fictionalized you know, account.
And in fact, if we're talking about this difference between fact and fiction, I was really psyched about seeing The Monuments Men, which was George Clooney's big film this year, which was, I'm sad to say, a terrible disappointment. But then Netflix streaming was running this fantastic documentary on the same subject called The Rape of Europa. And it had more tension, more drama, more depth in the characters. And I'm not sure what the disconnect is between the same story told in documentary and fiction. Sometimes one works better and sometimes other works better. It depends on the skill of the filmmaker.
Right.
So what are your biggest disappointments 2014, Laura?
I avoid all my big disappointments.
Wait a minute.
Because
don't you have to experience it before you're disappointed?
I feel pretty certain that yet another comic book hero movie is not going to give me a whole lot more information than the last comic book.
Yeah, I think
movie.
If you have no expectations, I mean, I did go see that Hunger Games movie, not of my own choice. And
Who took you?
It's a long story. How long do we have? Do we have 20 minutes?
Yet another show.
But, you know, and was I disappointed? No, because I had no expectations that it was going to be anything other than it was. I would have liked to have been pleasantly surprised, but I was, you know, I just was kind of bored and uninterested, and everything felt empty and expensive. Yeah. I was like, what? Couldn't I have spent that money on something?
You can do that. Or you can feel that way at work.
Right.
There's no point.
Low expectations can be a great gift, though, because sometimes you think something's going to be terrible. And in fact, I felt that way about Wild when I went to see it, because not knowing anything about the story more than the outline of it, I thought it was just going to be an excuse to have Reese Witherspoon raped on the trail, like Deliverance. And I was so relieved that that was not, you know, the trajectory of the film, that I think I had an extremely positive response to it, just because they sidestepped that whole issue in a way.
A deep pleasure, as always. Thank you so much, Laura Boies and Marcia Gordon. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Laura Boies is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, a program that is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.